Welcome to Soundbites, a series about the food we eat. We're going to spend the next year examining the entire system of how food gets to the farm to your table, including the history, politics, health, and environmental concerns, and the economics of wholesome food. You're already familiar with some of the issues. Our neighborhoods have become food deserts, with not a supermarket to be seen around us for miles. Our children are unhealthy with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure showing up at younger and younger ages. Many of us die too young from preventable diseases. We believe it doesn't have to be this way. Over the coming year, we're going to share stories about our food. We'll explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we get there together. Today on the show, we're joined by two farmers with thoughtful and very different analyses of our food system. Up first, we'll hear Lee Richardson, a contract chicken grower for Purdue who raises a million birds a year and grows corn and soybeans on his farm in Willards, Maryland. Lee and James Atkins of the Wicomico Young Farmers took us on a tour of the Richardson farm and spoke to us about some of the challenges facing farmers today. And then we'll revisit an interview we taped at Cottingham Farm with proprietor Cleo Braver. An environmental lawyer turned farmer, Cleo shares her vision for an agricultural system that doesn't harm the environment and ensures access to healthy food for all. Up first, here's Lee Richardson and James Atkins. As we stood next to some of the heavy machinery on Lee's farm, we began our discussion talking about one of the previous episodes of Soundbites on Delmarva that featured a panel of farmers discussing different approaches to agriculture, which Lee had listened to and James had been part of.
You know, everybody has a different thought on agriculture, and, you know, as far as what I got out of that day, you know, it's there are several different types of agriculture as far as levels that we're at, and if you look at organic, they can't feed the world. I don't see how. You know, I mean, that's where we started.
Right.
You know, 100 years ago, and they couldn't, you know, the population grew, so agriculture had to grow with it, and that's where it's brought us to today. We're more of a grain and poultry farm here, and, you know, feel like we, you know, the grain goes to the chickens to feed them, and then the chickens, you know, feed the people. But certainly if I had to go back, you know, if we went back to an outside flock, you know, to a small coop type thing, you know, I'm only going to feed a few people, you know, and right. I don't, who's going to decide who gets the food? You know, if I get to decide, you know, it's, some, a lot of people are going to starve because there ain't going to be much food to go around, you know, and they had the same comment on TV, you know, that to make it happen, people's got to eat less. Well, you know, we could all eat less, I'm sure, you know, but at the same time, you know, to dictate that, you know, but why do we draw ourselves to such a shortage, you know, that dictates how much we eat? You know, it could be a real problem. What if we have a bad year on, say, poultry production or just vegetable production, and you've already pulled it to that level that only what you're consuming or allowed to consume, you know, so who do we decide who starves that year? You know, that's what they did back then 100 years ago. They starved to death, you know, when things didn't go right, you know, and we're certainly trying to avoid that these days.
How many chickens do you have here?
My father and I have about 180,000 total. It's six houses. They're on two different farms, and we started out years ago with four smaller houses that are not in production any longer, and you know, it was to supplement the farming. You know, we had some pretty bad years there in the 80s farming, you know, $2 corn and stuff like that. So, you know, kind of got a little heavier in the chicken business to supplement that, you know, and stay in business. And it saved us a few years. So
is that 180 one season, or is that 180 that revolves?
That's every 10 weeks,
every
roughly.
10 weeks, so,
yeah.
That's a lot of chickens.
But, yeah. So, I mean, we grow a million birds a year between my father and I.
A million birds a year.
Yeah.
So if, just for argument's sake.
Sure.
Let's say you didn't have the houses. How many birds would you have?
If I didn't have the houses?
Yeah, if the birds were like some people would argue, free-range birds.
Yeah, if you did free-range birds, and what do you have to do with it, I would think 1,000 would be a lot in a year's time, you know, that you're talking about. Now, of course, it would take longer to...
For them to grow.
Should do. You know, even, you know, I'm not even talking, you know, they get in these arguments about growth hormones and all that, you know. I have to believe what Purdue tells me I'm their grower, but they provide the feed. But, you know, there is no growth hormones and all that stuff in there. So, in other words, they would grow close to the same amount if it was the same breed and there was food available, you know. But there lies the other thing. Back then, the outside flocks, they weren't a bird that we grow in these chicken houses. They've been bred to be in these chicken houses and perform, whereas the ones back then were bred, you know, they were, there were many different breeds, but, you know, they were, you know, qualified for outside, you know, more right. so and stuff like that, and to grow. But, you know, you're talking, you know, probably, you know, maybe 1,000, 2,000 birds between my father and I, we could probably do in a year's time. But then, you know, you're not going to have this big processing facility at that point either. So who cleans them and, you know, gets them? You know, there's some that will do it. You know, some of these organic farms are doing their own, but they don't have the manpower. I don't see them having the manpower to do a lot of birds,
right.
you know, because it'd have to be all the time to employ these people. So in other words, you know, you're doing 100 birds a week. You're not going to employ maybe one person, you know, full time. So, you know,
do you employ a lot of people to work the birds?
Not as far as producing. No, I've got one employee and my father and I take care of all of them. And now it can be long days sometimes when things aren't going right, or at certain points when you're getting between flocks. You know, we have some long days, and but that's all part of the business. You know, as long if you're not doing that, you're doing something else. You know, on the farm. But you know it. The constraints of it, you know, it keeps us here all the time. You know, pretty much when birds are in, you can't be far away.
Can't go away.
You know, because of them being in the house more so than outside. You know, there's some downfalls as far as for me as a producer, you know, because I have to be there. You know, if the power goes out, them generators better start, you know, and stuff like that, you know, to save them. And so we deal with that constantly.
So how long has this farm been in your family?
It goes back to at least my great-grandfather, possibly great-great-grandfather. We have information back to my great-grandfather, and then my grandfather tilled it, and then my father, and then, of course, him and I are partners now. So my grandfather passed away, so it's just the two of us, and we own, or we till about a little over 2,000 acres.
And soy and corn.
Soy and corn and a little bit of wheat, and that pretty much keeps us busy, you know. So
the chickens and that keep you a lot of busy.
Yeah, that's right.
So if you, I've always wanted to ask this question because people say this all the time. Is it true that you can't eat one of your chickens?
Is it true that I can't?
Yeah.
Technically, no. No, I'm not allowed to walk in there and kill one of these.
Can't,
that's right.
You can't go and
that's right. That's right. And you know, I'll go back to that. We'll go back to the processing part of it. I cleaned a chicken when I was a kid. It was for a contest and for. The poultry industry or something had a contest, you know, and we did it as kids. And I really don't want to kill my own chicken and clean it, you know. By the time you're done with it, you're thinking, you know, did I get it clean or not, or did I get anything on it, you know. But, you know, you feel like you put a lot of trust in these processing companies now, or a lot of belief in them because of what they do and the amount of birds they go through and the health. You know, people aren't, you know, we don't have the health problems from disease like a lot. Usually if you cook it right and all that, you know, if somebody doesn't cook it, you know, you might have salmonella. But as far as when you think of how many birds are going through a facility or something like that, and you know, people aren't getting sick from it, you know, it's a pretty big accomplishment, you know. And if you had, but you know, the health department is stretched pretty thin, or say the USDA is stretched pretty thin on if they had a processing location at every farm, you know, to do their own birds. Say, like if we went back to organics, you know, they wouldn't have the inspectors to keep up, you know, because they'd have to, you know, right now there's always inspectors in those facilities, you know, in the facilities as far as where they process the birds they're done. So in other words, if they had to have that at every farm, you know, they wouldn't have the manpower or the money, you know.
So when in this business, do you have to buy everything? You have to buy, pay for the houses, pay for the chickens, pay for it.
No, we provide the chicken houses, and
we pay for the chicken houses.
We provide the electricity and the water, and they provide the chicks. They provide the feed. And the heat is worked out in our performance with the flock. So we kind of pay for it, you know, in our performance. So you might as well say we pay for the heat, you know. So if you use a lot of heat, it's going to hurt you, or gas for the heat. But Purdue takes care of, in our case, takes care of the chicks and the feed. And we provide, you know, the servicing of them, or the taking care of them and stuff like that. And they provide a person that comes out once a week to make sure everything looks okay, and you know, that they don't see a problem, or if there is a problem with the chickens, they'll come out and look at them and stuff like that, you know. But the main part for us is the electricity, probably is our biggest cost these days, because it's gotten so high.
So the argument going back and forth all the time to environmentalists and farmers in the world here is the environmental damage that is caused by the chicken farms and the mass-producing chickens.
Right. In other words, the manure. Right. You know, that's the bottom, you know, that the big argument is the manure. And, you know, when I look back on history, even in my history, you know, I've been in it for, I'm 40 years old, so you can say I've really been heavy in it for 20 years and know what I was doing and knew what was going on. I went to college and, you know, knew about nutrients and all that. And back then, you know, we spread manure closest to the chicken house, the fields close to the chicken house. They had a manure spreader that kicked it straight up in the air. You drove out from under it. It's more or less to give you the basic. Now we have spinner spreaders that are much more efficient. They do a much better job. They carry a lot more. We go farther away because at about that time we found out what it was worth. We did a lot of research on our farm, particularly with the extension, that found, you know, instead of 10 tons of manure to grow corn, we could grow a crop with 3 tons, you know, the same crop. Well, obviously, you know, we're going to cut back to 3 and cover more acres. The problem is, you know, at that time we were just learning about it. You know, they actually thought it was worthless, pretty much. It was just litter, you know. And then they started to find out that it was, you know, worth a lot more. And of course, the more it was worth in value and nutrients, the more it was worth to us, you know, and saved us money on commercial fertilizer. Now, chicken manure is not free. Even if I had taken it out of my own chicken house, technically it's not free because you have to have that spreader and you have to have that tractor to pull it. And it takes a lot longer to spread it than it does commercial fertilizer because you don't get as far and it's a lot more time consuming. So, you know, the thought that it's free to us is, you know, way out of line. You know, in fact, it seems like if you buy, well, we bought some in the past and, you know, it actually gets pretty expensive now. But at the same time, you know, you got these farms that have no land and they've got a chicken house or several chicken houses in some cases, and they need a place for it. You know, they've got the agri-recycle just pelletizing it and sending it away. And then there is farmers that don't have any chickens, but they've got a lot of farmland. They're big farmers, you know, and they take it and spread it too. I don't personally know just how much manure there is, you know, or how many acres, you know, to really pan it out. You know, our manure varies from flock to flock. Sometimes you have a rainy spell during the flock, you know, for a couple weeks, you know, just seems like it's always rain or damp or whatever. We have a lot more crust that comes out. Then the next flock, you might hardly have a truckload to a house, you know, because it's drier air. You know, it's all in with the humidity and stuff like that, you know. And so it varies so much, it's hard to get a fix on it. And that's why there's that question, you know, well, how much manure are we producing? Well, it varies. Some poultry companies seem to produce a little more than others because they seem to have wetter houses, you know, whether it's, you know, something in the feed that, you know, makes them cause the floors to be a little wetter or just what, I don't know, drink more water. But of course, management's another issue. You know, if you're a poor manager in the chicken house, you're going to have wetter floors, you're not keeping your waters up and all that. We produce a lot less manure now than we used to for the fact that we used to have water pans in the chicken house that water sat in. Of course, it was, you know, then we went to a nipple drinker that they just tapped the nipple. Well, there's a lot less waste. You know, they kicked the pans off back in the day and flood the chicken house. You need to have a whole section flooded when you come in. You know, it was a disaster. But, you know, but then they went to a nipple and it was much cleaner water and all. It didn't just sit there, you know, during the day and whenever the chickens felt like drinking. You know, it was there at their leisure. It's cold, you know, it's cool and no bacteria growing it and stuff like that. So, you know, we've come a long way. We've done a lot of advancements to produce less manure. You know, I actually right now I'm in a program for the last 2 years that we don't even take manure out in between flocks until the end of the year when we need it for the fields. That's what we actually say, we're windrowing it in the chicken house to compost it, and it kills all the bacteria and stuff like that right inside the chicken house. It takes us about a good week to do it right, you know, to get the heat up, and then we turn it and get the heat up again, and then we spread it back out. So literally not taking anything out.
Are the chickens still in the house when you're doing that?
No, that's between flocks. In other words, about every 10 weeks. Flocks. Yeah. Okay, so in other words, then we'll wait till the time of the year that we really need it. So now some, it gets built up over time. Sometimes we have to take a little bit out and put it in a manure shed, you know, during the year because it gets built too thick in the chicken house. But and then come spring, you know, we're spreading time, we'll be able to take it right out, you know. And you know, I have my opinions. You know, there's been a lot of research done on these piles of manure. You know, a lot of people complain about that, and but you know, they've had a lot of research projects done by several universities that say it doesn't affect, you know, there is no leaching or whatever. In fact, one or two research projects, I just said it was worse when they covered the pile because of the sweating under the plastic and it ran out. So, you know, that it was actually did a little worse. So, you know, when it rains on these manure piles, if they're piled properly, now there's an issue there. If it's not piled properly, you know, it's strung out halfway down the field, you know, there's an issue. You know, because you got a lot more surface area. But when you pile it correctly, and it rains on it the first time, it forms a crust on the top, and about, if you're lucky, it gets crusted 6 inches deep at the most, then the rest of that pile is dry as the day you put it there. So it's like it's covered, you know, but that's what you deal with, you know. You try to teach this stuff, you know, and educate people on it, and some listen, some don't, you know. And when the universities do it, you think that it'd be set in stone then, you know, they've done the research and got the, you know, intelligence to do it, and yet nobody still believes them, you know, and it becomes a headache for farmers.
Is it true that people, like, let's say us, we can't go in the chicken houses? You're not supposed to take folks into the chicken house, right?
For biosecurity reasons is the main thing, you know, because sometimes you can be, well, just the simplest thing, if you have a pet bird, it can have diseases that you can have on you that it won't kill that bird, but you take it into that chicken house, it's something that they're susceptible to and could be a real issue. I mean, it could be a real issue, you know, wipe out the whole house, you know, if it's avian influenza or whatever, you know, or your bird might die the next day because you didn't know it was sick. But my point is, you know, it's a biosecurity reason. We know who's going in and out and can keep track of it, you know, and it's just employees or company people. And, of course, when the company people come in, they have to wear proper clothing and stuff like that to prevent from spreading. Because sometimes they're going from one farm to the next, and they have to change their clothes and stuff like that to keep from spreading anything.
Yeah, diseases can travel.
That's right.
But even if you had the proper clothing, you really could, I mean, produce more. The company has more people going into chicken.
I do a lot of, actually, I have done quite a few tours, but it's with their approval. Uh-huh. You know, in other words, I don't know that I've never asked them and they've rejected for somebody to go in there. You know, I let them know ahead of time to make sure they know it so I don't get in trouble. But at the same time, they've never said no. You know, the main thing was proper clothing, you know, and all that.
Parakeet disease into your chicken.
That's right. You know. So that's, you know, that's a big worry, you know, and because who's going to pay for it, you know, when you do it, you know. I mean, when it comes down to, you know, you figure, you know, it might be $10,000 a house that I've lost. That's not counting what Purdue lost, you know, at the end of that flock. So, you know, that's what you deal with, and that's why, you know, it's so important to keep it controlled.
Right.
But, yeah, I've had several people, you know, want to learn about it, you know, and it's amazing. I mean, I'm surprised we had a Salisbury University class come out and look at the chickens, and they were amazed. They were expecting to walk in there and see cages. Uh-huh. You know, that all these houses on the Eastern Shore are caged birds, but not at all. They kind of thought they were free roaming, you know, the way they got to roam around the chicken house. And, you know, they obviously saw that they weren't packed in there so tight they couldn't sit down or move around or whatever. And it was real enlightening to them, you know. So you hope you've taught something, you know, and that it's not what everybody, you can't believe everything you hear or see or read. So, you know.
Right. And then the arguments that some people make, and this is actually the first time I'm asking these questions, because over the course of the year we'll ask them more and go back and forth, but the people argue that the chickens themselves, whether it's Tyson, Purdue, whoever it is, it's just not as healthy as other chickens. It's because of what's put in them, what makes them grow as fast as they grow.
Well, that's getting back to what I said earlier about the growth hormones, but, you know, there is no growth hormones and antibiotics and all that. Like, whether there was at one time, I'm not sure, you know, because something got the thing going, but, you know, we don't even use coccidiostat anymore. Purdue got away from that, which had the arsenic in it, you know, it was part of that, and it's not in there anymore. And we're actually going through some kind of vegetative feed, you know. It's pretty much vegetarian,
right?
And that's what they're eating now, you know. So, you know, they're always making changes when they can, you know. At one time they couldn't figure out how to make it without the coccidiostat, but as far as I know, they've never used growth hormones. Of course, one company says they don't. I guess somebody, you know, Tyson kind of advertised there at one time that they were hormone free and all that, indicating that everybody else used them, you know. So, but they kind of got in trouble for that, you know. But that's the point, you know. All this stuff gets started, but, you know, I certainly buy and eat Purdue chicken every day. You know, I have no problem with buying it, you know, and I know, you know, I feel like I know as much about it as I can, and certainly no problems as far as health problems or anything like that from it. You know, I think it's just a lot of hearsay or, you know, worrisome. You know, people worry a lot. I mean, you sit in the house. You know, people today working in an office, it's air, purified water. You go to the water. You don't go to a water fountain anymore. You go to the tub there, you know, and get your water. I mean, I drink out of the spigot here, you know, and I'm still kicking pretty strong, you know. But, you know, my grandparents lived to be an old age. My grandfather smoked and worked in the chicken house. You know, and I'm not saying everybody can do that, but I'm saying there's a lot in genetics and there's a lot in your resistance, you know. In other words, when you're in purified everything, well, how do you build an immune system? You know, I don't understand it. You know, when I'm out, you know, I know we've got the advantage of being out here all the time and in the air and all that, you know, and I get sick very little. My wife gets sick very little. My daughter, you know, it's, you know, we have a spell here and there in the wintertime, but, you know, got a strong immune system, and I think that's got a lot to do with it. You
know, outdoors and working.
Yeah, you know, just being out in it, you know, and building an immune system.
Right.
And so, in other words, you know, I just feel like it's not as bad as what everybody makes it out to be, you know. And so I don't know what else to say about it, you know. Just,
if this wasn't here, what would you do? If Purdue wasn't here, what would you do? Could you survive without it?
Well, I can tell you it'd be a lot less acres. Uh-huh. I would probably not, I don't know, I'd probably be just as busy because it would definitely be all vegetables then because I'd be feeding humans directly and not chickens. You know, the grain market would be gone. If Purdue and Tyson, there would be no grain market.
Right.
There wouldn't be enough grain market for us to grow it here and ship it anywhere else. Because when the poultry companies leave here, I fear you're looking at Brazil, South America. They can sustain their own. They really can. They export quite a bit. So, in other words, they would be able to grow what they needed. So, they're not going to buy from us. The export markets don't go out of here very easily like they do out of the Mississippi River. So, grain market would be gone. So, you take the rest of the acres, and it would probably become houses or vegetables. You know, and, you know, some of this land is not even good for vegetables. But, in other words, you would feed the people going to Ocean City or the locals and stuff like that. All of us can't do it, you know, because if everybody tried to do it, then the market would be flooded and we wouldn't make anything, so it wouldn't be any good. So I'm not sure how long we'd make it without it, you know, once the chickens were gone, whether we, you know, would be able to survive. I don't know. I certainly would not be renting any ground, you know. I'd just be the ground I owned and maybe could make it, you know.
A lot of acres for the free grain.
Yeah. From people that own land that don't farm, you know, we rent it. And that kind of makes it so we can justify owning bigger equipment to get across it and get done faster. Because our winter gets tighter every year, you know. It seems like wind, rain, and everything. You know, we have
to get... The environment has been changed. The last few years have been tough.
Yeah. It's been rough. And the dry weather's not helping us too much here, you know. So, you know, we're hoping for some more rain. We had some finally this weekend, but it's pulled a lot of it, you know, out of it a little bit. So we're hoping, you know, I know some other places it's too late already, you know, for some of their corn. So we're hoping we'll get some more here soon.
Because you have a lot tied up in this.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, yeah, people don't realize, you know, a sprayer, you know, this alone is over $250,000. A combine's, you know, $300,000 plus, you know, and then that's just two pieces of equipment. That, all that does is spray and all that does is harvest. But then you got tractors that can do lots of different things, but they're $100,000 a piece, you know, give or take. And then the planter now, a planter now costs over $100,000, you know, that used to probably cost... what, 25,000, 30,000, you know, when I was younger. But, you know, that's, it just gets more expensive. But the problem is, you know, if you till several acres, you know, you have to have the larger equipment to get across it, you know. And plus, I mean, even the smaller farmers, you know, need stuff to get across it because, like I said, the wind is getting tighter. The weather doesn't cooperate. It seems like we have wind all the time.
Yeah.
So when you are trying to spray, you're trying to keep drift at a minimum. So, you know, you're trying to get it, you know, in that short window. So... it's always a challenge. There's ever, you know, a lot of challenges. The challenges I don't need, well, you know, I can deal with those. The challenges I don't need is water keepers suing me or environmentalists thinking they know my job better than I do or what I do better than I do. You know, you talk to most of them, how many times they've been on a farm? How much time have they actually spent on a farm? I'd love to give them 10 acres and say, have at it, you know. And, you know, as far as the organic growers, I, you know, wish them all the luck. I mean, they've hit a niche market. And I think they can move it. And but if we all got into it, they're in trouble too, because we can't all do it, you know. And there's such a big push for it. But there's only so many acres that we need for that, because there's only going to be so many people that buy that, because, you know, it's going to be more expensive because it costs more to grow it that way. And so it's going to have to be the people that are willing to pay that extra. And but not everybody is, you know. That some of them want it mass produced to be cheaper. And mass produced isn't a bad thing. I don't feel like it is. Not what I do as far as chickens, you know. As far as mass produced washers and dryers from China and stuff like that, I don't know, you know, when you get into that kind of stuff. But, you know, we still, you know, looking for quality, you know, and stuff like that, and take a lot of pride in what we do here as far as the grain or the chickens.
Right.
We need to figure out how to educate the people, you know, because I think a lot of it's misconception. You know, my daughter said something, somebody come home and said something, you know, well, it was what they call an old wives' tale, you know, and if you look it up, you know, that's what it is. It's not a true thing, you know, but you don't know until you look it up, you know, but there's a lot of stuff out there, a lot of misconceptions, and we're trying to get it out, you know, and we want them to understand what we're doing, and it's not as bad as what they think, you know, but the problem is getting there, you know. Nobody lives on a farm anymore, you know, everybody's 2 times, 3 times removed from the farm. They don't have grandparents to go visit in the summer, or, you know, to spend a day on the farm or a week, right. You know, they used to spend with their grandparents. They don't even have great-grandparents. You know, if their great-grandparents were living, they might not even been farmers, you know.
And if your family wasn't a farming family, you probably wouldn't be farming.
It'd be very difficult. I mean, I know some that are trying to get into it, it'd be very difficult. You know, not only the cost, now the organics is a cheaper way to get it and started, but it still costs more to grow it,
because,
you know, but
as Ted and those guys told me, they don't buy these things.
Right.
They say there's no reason for debt, there's no reason for subsidies, because they don't have to go.
That's right.
There's no need for this.
Nobody
right.
subsidizes that.
No, yeah. Don't give it up. Yeah. Yeah. You know. And that's the thing, you know, subsidies has become a bad word too, you know. Now it's, you know, more of the 80s when corn was $2 and all that, and farmers were going out of business and losing everything, you know, because they were struggling, you know, to make ends meet and stuff like that, and didn't really matter. It was getting to the point, it didn't matter if you had a good crop or not. It was getting, you know, the prices were getting so low and wearing hard on us. But you know, crop insurance takes care of things, and I'm certainly satisfied with that. I don't need direct payment, you know, free money, you know. Some will argue with that, you know, and I don't, you know, they have different reasonings, but, you know, crop insurance is what we buy now, and it does pretty good. Now, the government does keep the cost of the insurance low. They said, they claimed that if they didn't, that we wouldn't be able to afford it. It wouldn't be affordable to even buy it. But, you know, we buy it every year to protect ourselves, you know, and it's been a big help. And that's kind of taking the pressure off the chickens carrying everything, you know, because when it's dry like this, you know, it kicks in and helps pay the bills.
Right, right.
So, but yeah, I mean, I'd like to see subsidies go sometimes with, you know, 100%, so you didn't hear about it, you know, because it's like welfare, you know, and I don't think much of welfare in a certain degree, you know, and I think they could do a better job of distributing it in the years past. There were some years there that it didn't quite go like I think it should have done as far as back in the 80s and stuff like that. It didn't necessarily go to the man that needed it the most. And I think that probably bothered me more than anything, and kind of hopefully made changes, and that's why they went to the direction they went. Crop insurance, it only helps the man that needs it.
So you don't feel like, or people you know in your world business, whether it's Purdue or Tyson or whoever people raise chickens for, that you're an industrial farmer, that you're like,
no,
you know, that word.
The name on the sign says Ridge and Farms Incorporated, but it's my father and I. Right. My mother does the books, and then we have one employee. So I don't see how they get an industrial farm out of that, you know. And certainly not. I don't feel like it is. You know,
CAFO's is where, right?
Yeah, CAFO would be a confined animal feeding operation. Right. We are considered a CAFO because of the number of birds we have and all. And, you know, put any kind of label you want on it. You know, we do everything we can to protect the waters. You know, the waters are important to us, too. And the environment's important to us, too. I mean, certainly everybody still wants to move here. And there's a reason for it, because it is such a nice environment. And I don't have any intention to move in. So, you know, I certainly want to keep it for my children and stuff like that. And my niece and nephews that, you know, spend their time here and all that. Certainly, you know, if we ruin it for them, you know, we've not done too good. But, you know, just I think you're dealing with a lot of new stuff these days, and they still have the mentality that the farmer is still somebody that didn't finish the 8th grade and is doing it. And it's not quite that anymore. A lot of us are college educated and know what we're doing and how to run it and protect it and stuff like that. And, you know, and there's always going to be bad apples in the bunch, no matter what business you're in. I mean, and I'm sure there's some out there, and, you know, some have been caught, you know, and taken care of. You know, or corrected, let's put it that way. And some of them, you know, it might have been an issue of an education, you know, but a lot of them are getting educated these days, that, you know, and it's getting straightened out. And I think that'll make the biggest difference than anything.
Everybody we've met today has gone to college.
And I think that's going to be the norm rather than the exception.
Right. For the most part, I don't know how, you know, I know some that haven't been, so, you know, I'll give them credit, you know, and stuff like that. But at the same time, they don't understand a lot of this regulations and stuff when it comes to what we have to do as far as paperwork. That's where they get in the biggest trouble, and as far as that. But as far as being able to drive a tractor or plant a seed, no. But to know what that seed can do or what you're allowed to use on that seed, it's getting more difficult all the time because of genetics and stuff like that. So certainly a college education brought me a long ways because I took agriculture. You know, I didn't take business or something. I had some business classes and stuff like that and a little bit of everything. But certainly it was, you know, to help out, to come back to the farm.
You went to Maryland, too?
Delaware. University of Delaware, yeah. Yep. And so it was good education. You know, went trade for the world. And I think you need it today, really, just for the information.
Yeah, yeah.
At one time, you could start out farming, and you really, you know, high school degree or high school education would have been fine. And this day and age, you really need a college education if you're going to try and do it. You know, you're not going to start out without it.
You've been listening to Lee Richardson and James Atkins, both farmers in Wicomico County, Maryland. Don't go away, because Soundbites on Delmarva will be right back. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. 1-800-638-7781. Welcome back to Soundbites on Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Up next, organic farmer Cleo Braber offers a very different take on the food system and how we can transform agriculture to ensure sustainable, healthy food for all. I started by asking her to describe her farm.
It's like a 156-acre farm. It's actually the quintessential Maryland farm where it used to be, as far as averages go, for the average size farm, the average size of actual fields. You know, we had three fields that totaled 90 acres that were in the traditional feed corn, feed soy rotation, and I use that word loosely. And just out of my environmental work, you know, I was an environmental lawyer for 20 years.
Who'd you work for?
I was general counsel for a public company called Environmental Elements Corporation.
So you're here on the insurance, so you found yourself here. You came here.
I found myself here, and I realized, you know, I think it's when I realized that as you're taking a drink and strolling along the banks in the evening and you see the fish jumping, I used to think, oh, how lovely, the fish are frolicking and feeding and... And I don't know where I learned this, but that they're really, what they're doing is aerating the water so they can survive from dusk to dawn when the dissolved oxygen levels are the lowest. And I guess once you know that, it's hard to sleep at night. Mm-hmm. So environmental issues have sort of always driven me. And I just became, you know, curious about what it was and, you know, what was contributing to it. And I really came to focus from a lot of different analysis and talking to other folks that and looking at the scientists, which I think it's really what you have to look at is the scientific information, because we can all argue till the cows come home, but I think you got to look at the science. And the science, at least independent scientists, were saying that a significant portion of the pollution in the bay, nitrogen, the phosphorus, the sediment, it's coming from agriculture. And while agriculture has done an awful lot, there remains a lot to be done, in part because this is tenant farming systems here.
Tenant farming?
It's tenant farming. So the farmers will implement these good environmental practices on their own home farms, but they're not implemented on the farms that they farm for others. And that's about 65, maybe even as high as 80% of the farmland. So, you know, cover crops are not routinely put on. You know, buffer strips, that's the real big one. There's no buffer strips. I mean, they farm right up to the edge of the ditches. And that's just a system that's made to carry the excess nitrogen, the excess phosphorus, and the sediment. 5 tons an acre of sediment, 10 pounds an acre of phosphorus, and 100 pounds of nitrogen and then phosphorus. It's just, The system is made to pollute the bay. It's designed to pollute the
Not
bay.
Not consciously designed, you don't think? Designed, in fact, of how it...
You know, they want water to run off the land. They don't want it to sit and get wet. They, you know, they want to preserve their crops. But the you know, the fact is, you know, you look at the science coming out of Horn Point and other places. If you put plug in efficacy of buffer to absorb nutrients, enter, you'll get hundreds of studies. You'll get scores of compendia of studies from around the world that say you need a minimum of 65-foot buffer. You know, the nitrogen goes down, so you really need the cover crops.
Between farm and water.
Between, no, not farm and water. There's another huge fallacy. Between the edge of every farm field and the rest of the land. Because, you know, we're all in the watershed, whether you live on the water or not. I mean, it's all in the watershed, so it's really every farm field edge has to be buffered. And there are zoning requirements in place that I think, for the most part, you know, aren't enforced at all. And there should be, you know, there should be buffers in place because it does yeoman's work and it protects us. It protects us all, and the farmers should be compensated. And they are. There are compensation programs that CREP, CRP, that compensates, but the compensation goes to the land owner and the farmer if he suggested to the landowner, gee, why don't we put in some buffer strips? We'll share the proceeds and we'll be the same. We'll get just as much money as we would growing corn. The farmers are afraid to have those conversations with the owners.
What's the delineation you just made between farmer and owner?
Well, like for instance, this farm, you know, we had an operator who comes in and they farm your you know, we don't have the farm equipment to do the big fields, and so it's a farmer who, let's say, you know, a guy who farms 2,000 acres, he'll farm 300 or 500 on his home farm that he owns, and right. The other 1,500 right. will be farmed on land owned by others. And the structure is set up so that the CREP payments go to the owner, and the owner doesn't know about the CREP. And I'm sure if owners knew about these programs and understood them fully, they would have a conversation with their farmer and say, let's implement them. I'll share the proceeds with you. And it's a wash. You don't make any less money. You know, the federal programs as implemented by the states exist, but they're just not implemented in any meaningful way in the state of Maryland because of the tenant farming structure.
Well, I mean, I just want to get this clear in some terms. I mean, because most farmers I know farm the way you described. Is that they have the land, but they also rent land from other people around to do their work. I mean, that wherever we are in Maryland, that's how people farm. People farm like that all over the country. But that's different than tenant farming, which is when you're actually literally working for somebody else and...
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm using the wrong term, but the notion is that most of the operators who actually do farm with the big equipment, they do a small percentage of it on their own land, and the rest is on land that they engage in one of a couple different relationships with the owner.
Right.
But the end result is, you know, whether they're bearing the risk and paying a certain, you know, fee to the owner of the land, or it's cost share where they share the cost, they share the revenue. The end result is still the same. The programs are set up, the federal programs are set up so that the owner gets the payment. The farmer is kind of reluctant to have a conversation with the owner because they're legitimately, you know, concerned that if they told the owner about the programs, the owner would go, let's carve those 100-foot buffers out of all of our fields. And it takes up a lot of space, let me tell you. I mean, in our 90 acres, it was like 25 acres to have a 100-foot buffer. So it takes up a lot of the acreage. And, you know, you don't want to have the farmers have less to farm. And so they're reluctant to approach owners, tell them about the program, so they have the conversation and then share it. But I think owners, for the most part, if they understood what great work it would be for the bay, what a great help it would be to the bay, they would say, hey, I didn't know about that. Let's do that together, and let me share the proceeds with you.
And so, because it's not a law, you're not required to build these buffers.
No, you're not. You're not required. You're not required to build. No. And it's just a matter of knowing that the programs exist, having conversations between farmers and owners and saying, hey, this is a great program. Hey, we're already paying the federal tax dollars, right, in Maryland, but the programs are being implemented in other states. So it's just the sound of money leaving Maryland. You know, as long as we're paying the taxes for these programs, let's get them implemented here in a meaningful way. So that, to me, is one thing I sort of discovered about, you know, why is it that there's not more? And that's got to be it. And I can only go on my own experience as an owner. I mean, look, I was an environmental lawyer. My husband's in environmental businesses. You know, we didn't really understand that those programs existed until I started kind of like scratching the surface, you know. And our farmer operator, you know, didn't volunteer the information. And you can understand why they'd be reluctant to do so.
Because they lose money.
Because they would assume that an owner being driven by profit's going to go, thanks for that information. Let's carve out 30 acres of our 90 acres. We're going to put crep buffers in, and we're going to get all the proceeds, and you'll have less acreage to farm. And you may not even be coming down the lane anymore because it's got less acreage and becomes more and more fragmented. And you know, you end up having all the development pressure. But so there's a program that exists that's not being taken advantage of in a meaningful way in the state of Maryland. That's problem one. But the bigger problem, I think, is that, you know, the agriculture that exists here is feed corn, which goes to feed CAFO chickens, which aren't meant to eat corn. And so they need to give them antibiotics, daily non-therapeutic doses of antibiotics to survive. What is it now? 39 days? One farmer was saying at a public meeting it takes 39 days to grow a chicken to harvest. And they need antibiotics to survive the environments that they live in and the foods that they're fed. And so it's creating antibiotic-resistant bacteria like MRSA. Look at the work that Dr. Ellen Silbergill is doing at Johns Hopkins. You know, that's an issue of concern. So you've got feed corn, which has high nitrogen requirements, which there's some studies that indicate, you know, that, you know, up to 60% of the nitrogen doesn't actually get taken up by the corn. It ends up into the Chesapeake Bay if you don't have cover crops on. The phosphorus, if you don't have, you know, crep buffers. And so then it goes to feed the CAFO chickens, and then the CAFO chickens go, you know, to feed chicken McNuggets. And
the system you're talking about was created historically by business to figure to feed masses of people in America inexpensively because people couldn't afford food.
But cheap food has a high price. And the high price is all those externalized costs. And the externalized costs that are not reflected in the cost of the food, you know, is the environmental costs of nitrogen and phosphorus and sediment going into the Chesapeake Bay and killing the bays and killing the Gulf of Mexico and hypoxia and dead zones. And it's the healthcare costs because we're eating, you know, food that's not good for us. I mean, we're eating corn syrup, basically. We're corn walking, as they say, in the wonderful spate of, you know, new movie releases, Food Inc. And, you know, it's a problem. And our healthcare costs are tremendous. The Centers for Disease Control estimates it's like 50% of our healthcare costs are totally avoidable by things like, you know, our diet, our failure to exercise and other volitional acts like smoking. But it can have a tremendous impact on the healthcare costs of this country. This new kind of agriculture that's emerging in pockets, you know, creates jobs too. I mean, you know, some of the really intense agriculture like this, like greenhouse agriculture, can create, you know, 4, 5, 6 jobs an acre. So it can create jobs. We can create a system where Marylanders are paying Marylanders to grow food rather than Floridians and Californians and Mexicans and Canadians. It can help provide, you know, land to implement environmental practices because it's labor-intensive food production, not land-intensive. So the land can be freed up to do these environmental practices. There's a lot of bennies. There's multiple benefits by converting to the old way of eating. I mean, just look at the miles traveled, you know, of food in this country. I mean, it's a significant part of our energy costs.
The farmer you talked about who rents land from you or anybody else has to make a living. And that when they put buffers in, that saves the bay. And when he can't grow his mass feed corn for the chicken industry, then the farmer says, in many ways, maybe quite rightly, how am I going to survive? I can't make a living if I do these things immediately. What do I do?
Well, I think that there'll be some farmers who will convert, just like the tobacco farmers, you know, with the help of the state, converted to growing wine grapes. I'm not saying that they should be doing this on their own. It's a system that, frankly, was put into place because the subsidies were created to incentivize farmers to grow so much feed corn. I mean, we wouldn't have these huge amounts of feed corn and feed soy unless they're being paid tremendous federal subsidies to do so. I mean, some of the larger farmers, you know, get over $1 million a year to grow feed corn and feed soy. And, you know, they're not doing what they're doing because they want to poison the Chesapeake Bay and create obesity. I mean, they're doing it because society said to them, hey, do this. This is so important. We'll pay you to do it. If you look at, like, for instance, if you look at the USDA charts of mm-hmm. the different states of, you know, what do different states produce? You know, we're number 4 in broiler production. We're number, I don't know, 4 to 7 in feed corn. You look at dairy, you know, you look at beef cattle, you look at vegetables, fruits, nuts. You know, we're Zippo. We're zippity-doo-dah. You know, there's a whole agricultural vibrant economy that can be created.
This and used so to be some, dairy land.
Used to be dairies, used to be peaches, used to be wheat, you know, wheat in George Washington's time to feed the troops. I mean, you know, just because it's been corn for 45 years doesn't mean it always has to be. You know, some farmers won't convert. Some will. Some will convert some of their land, not maybe not all of it, but it can be, you know, the new vision, I think, the alternative vision is to say we're actually growing food for people rather than food for animals. It takes much less land to do so, less freeing up land for environmental practices, creates a lot of jobs. Hopefully, would have this impact in a fairly short term on healthcare costs, and they've got to be helped to do it. I mean, I agree. We've led them down this path, and there needs to be we need to really convert some of the subsidies that are in the farm bill from corn to more sustainable, more diverse, sustainable agriculture that's not monoculture.
You're listening to our conversation with Cleo Braver, owner of Cottingham Farm in Easton. We decided to take a walk outside to look at a few of her fields. I asked her about the challenge facing large institutions that want to purchase food in a more sustainable way.
There's so many hospitals like Maryland Hospitals for Healthy Environment, Louise Mitchell.
Yeah.
They're all looking at, like, you know, redoing their contracts with the food suppliers, you know, having 10% be local, 10% be, you know, pesticide free. Prisons. I've had prisons that are interested in buying, you know, food. I mean, large institutions really are trying to affect change. But we need to grow more farmers to grow this food. And one of the other impediments is a lot of schools and hospitals now no longer actually have, I've heard this, have kitchens to make food. They really just set up now to reheat the ARA or, you know, the Cisco and... So there's other limitations. I mean, the system's gotten so ingrained that an awful lot has to kind of be changed before it can be implemented.
So talk about this place, okay. Your place. Your Covington Farm? Is it?
It's Cottingham Farm.
Cottingham Farm.
It turns out that it's been called this since 1662. The Jonathan and William Shaw brothers from their estate Cottingham in Yorkshire, England, got a 900-acre land grant from the then Lord Baltimore. So as I say, it's 3 fields, and they were feed corn, and one of the fields has very wet soils, hydric soils, and so on the advice of Chesapeake Wildlife Heritage, Ned Gerber at Chesapeake Wildlife Heritage, you know, we're lucky enough to have in our backyard a not-for-profit organization that builds disappearing habitat. So mm-hmm. we've got lots of fields of houses and that sort of thing, but we're missing mostly grasslands and wetlands. Those are the 2 habitats that we're really missing in the Eastern Shore. So we turned our wet field into a wetland. And so now we have, you know, in addition to the Canada geese and the mallards, which you see a lot of, you know, because there's such high amounts of corn here, we're seeing the birds that have kind of disappeared, you know, like the teal and... And then we've got a pond, we've got woodies and black duck again. So and the bird club comes out and counts the bird species. So that's what we did with one of the fields. The first thing we did was put in buffers. We put in 100-foot buffers. And then we figured out, well, what do you do with the inside of the fields? So on the wet field, we put the wetland in. And in the buffers, by the way, the buffers are like warm season grass mixes. So it's like switchgrass, big blue stem, little blue stem, side oats, gamma, a lot of other things I can't remember. But they create, you know, they're perennial, they're deep-rooted, so they absorb, you know, the water and the sediment and the nutrients that would otherwise run off. So now in a rain event, you know, you used to see muddy water just running off the fields into the creek. We're on the Goldsboro Creek, which runs into the Miles River. So now you don't see water leave. It just, it stays in because the buffer's really doing a good job absorbing it. But also the buffer creates habitat like the quail. We've lost like 85% of our quail in the last 25 years. So we have quail coming back again. And it didn't take very long, like a year or 18 months, you know, after putting in these things, before our farm just started sounding different, looking different, and feeling different. I mean, the you know, nature really wants to heal itself. You give it a little bit of an opportunity, and it really does heal. So that's been really exciting. So then the second field, we put greenhouses up.
That's what we saw coming in.
Yeah, right. And those are just these, you know, high tunnels. They're unheated, and it just extends the season for the crops. It doesn't give you that many degrees differential. It'll give you 30-degree differential in the summer when you don't want it, and only 4 in the winter when you do. You know, nature doesn't like us when we try to trick her. But it does do yeoman's work keeping the really heavy rains off the crop. So, you know, in these times of increasingly odd weather patterns and just torrential rains, the high tunnels really make a difference to protect your crops. So last year, most of my tomatoes outside failed because of the heavy rains last summer, but the ones inside the tunnels were unbelievably, you know, beautiful and productive and pristine. They're also incredibly high productions. You can get 10, 15, depends on what the crop is, 20 times higher yields.
What can you grow in there besides tomatoes? What kinds of things can you grow in there?
Well, right now we've pulled out the tomatoes for the most part, and we're growing greens. We grow carrots. We grow kale, 4 colors of kale, 4 kinds of chard. We grow mizuna. We do arugula, tatsoi, lettuces, topi amaranth. I mean, nice little salad mix. We make a nice little Cottingham Farm salad mix. And then we have greens, which, you know, they're really hard to come by. You know, you go to a you know, there's some great local restaurants that are featuring local foods and really, get that we need to eat more vegetables. But, you know, a lot of restaurants treat vegetables like confetti. It's just this little colorful confetti on your plate. You know, I want to sit down. My husband and I make a pound of arugula every night. You're a pound of kale. We need to eat our vegetables. We need to eat our vegetables. And we grow carrots. We grow really, really sweet, sweet carrots that are like candy.
So now what's the other field? There's a third field.
So then the third field is this, the big one here. And we have a little teeny field here where we rotate. We're trying to set up a true rotation, which we'll have this year where, you know, land is fallow for 1 year in the rotation. And this field is basically left open. And what we've done is we've put in this space and the other open space is 24 acres of cover crops. The first one failed. We put one in May and it failed. And we've got another one that we've just finished putting in about 10 days ago. And we're hoping we're going to be using that the last field as pasture for animals. So I'd like to get into, you know, pastured poultry. Because, you know, most Americans don't, well, I didn't know. Maybe most Americans do know. But, you know, all these things that you're learning, reading things like Michael Pollan's Omnivore's Dilemma and The End of Food and Robin's book on food revolution. You know, if you look at a CAFO egg, a confined animal feed operation egg versus a pastured egg, and you ask the average person what's the difference, and they'll say 20 cents, because there's a 20-cent difference. One's affirmatively good for you, and one's affirmatively bad for you. One actually has high levels of the bad cholesterol, which I can never remember, HDL versus LDL, mm-hmm. but the other has high levels of the good cholesterol, low levels of the bad cholesterol, high levels of vitamin D, because the bird's been outside, and tocopherols. And the same thing with meat. If you look at a corn-fed steak versus a grass-fed steak, one has 7 times the levels of saturated fat. Same thing with vegetables. If you eat a vegetable that's had pesticides applied to it, it's got very limited nutrient value because pesticides, I mean, the natural defense of a plant against pests is to produce, one of the defenses is to produce antioxidants. So once humans intervene in the system and spray pesticides, you know, the plant signals stop antioxidant production. So you'll have less antioxidants in a typical vegetable that's been supplied with pesticides, sprayed with pesticides, than one that has not. So there's real differences in our food that the American public really deserves to know about and doesn't.
That was Cleo Braver, owner of Cottingham Farms in Easton. Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of On Delmarva. On Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Christopher Rank at Public Radio Delmarva. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.